Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Chris Van Dusen. Head to the lake, take the boat out onto the water, sing a song, befriend a sea monster. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 356 of the podcast with Chris Van Dusen. Chris's art is readily recognizable on the Mercy Watson chapter book series by Kate DiCamillo, as well as a slew of well-loved picture books. In our conversation, we talk about Hattie and Hudson, his newest as both author and illustrator, and the first book Chris has authored in prose and not rhyme, though that song sung by Hattie may scratch that itch just a little. Chris's camera work, as I like to put it, in this picture book brought me right to the scene and showed life out in the lake in ways that celebrated the elusiveness and the grandeur of the creature in the lake. Hudson is an impressive sight, and even talking about it now brings back a flood of images from the book. I can't wait to talk about that first underwater illustration with you as you get a chance to read it. Until then, I hope you enjoy our conversation. Here's episode number 356 of the podcast with Chris Van Dusen. Welcome to the podcast, Chris Van Dusen. I'm so glad you're here.
Well, thank you so much. It's so great to be on.
Your art is on so many things, Chris. I know you as being a librarian, and I know you from painting pigs that like buttered toast, and I know you from painting people in the bathtub and kings with egos and all these things. And here I have you painting sea monsters, and it's like the greatest thing. So I'm glad I get to talk to you.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, it's really, really an honor to be on here with Matthew, because I listen to you all the time. And while I'm working, I throw the podcast on and working away. And so it's really nice to be here and talking to you in person.
Man, that is the meta thing that goes on. If we can just give a look behind the scenes, for me, the idea that people that make books that eventually I'll be reading to my readers were listening while they were making books. Like, it's just, Oh boy. It's crazy. It's neat, though. So I'm glad that, thank you. I'm glad that you're inviting me and all these other great artists and authors into your ears while you're making this beautiful art. It's very good.
Oh, yeah. It's great. It's very inspirational.
So let's talk. Let's jump in. I want, if you don't mind, I'm going to give you a chance just to talk about what is Hattie and Hudson. What's your book talk? How are you telling people what this is?
Well, it's so new. I really haven't had a chance to really talk about
right?
much,
but maybe but I'll book talk it for you.
Yeah, go for it. You can do the color play, the play by play. Hattie and Hudson is a little different book for me because it's with Candlewick Press, which I've done a lot of books with. But it's the first time I've written a book that's a non-rhyming book. So that's a little different, and it was actually really hard. I couldn't believe how hard it was. I have friends who are writers, and they say, I don't know how you write in rhyme. And right. now I want to say to them, I don't know how you write in prose, because it was a struggle. But anyway, but it's a book. It's basically a book about a girl named Hattie. Probably she's about 11 years old, although it's never mentioned in the text. And she loves to explore, and she lives on a lake in Maine with her parents. And she just loves going out in the canoe every day and just checking out the lake and seeing what's swimming by or what's flying overhead. Or she's just really into exploring nature and sort of being outside. And one day she's just so happy. She just can't help it. She just starts singing a song in her canoe. And she summons up this gigantic lake monster from the bottom, from a cave down the bottom of the lake. I know I'm going to terrify all little kids now, but he comes up and they have sort of this connection. And then after that, it sort of becomes a sort of a combination of like a Beauty and the Beast and Frankenstein in a way, because later on in the book, the people in the town, well, they don't actually have torches, but they basically try to drive away this creature because they're just scared to death of him. And she and the monster sort of come up with this plan to save him and keep him in his home in the lake. So it's really too a book about sort of not judging by appearance. I don't love making books or writing books that have a strong message, because I just, you know, I really certainly don't want to force feed, you know, a message down a kid's throat while they're trying to enjoy a book. But this does have an important message about, you know, acceptance and not judging. And it's, I don't think it's like right in your face, but it's definitely sort of the underlying theme of the book.
Yeah, and also the message from, you know, your good friend Uncle Chris, which is never go out on the lake and sing or else sea monsters will get you.
That's right.
Actually,
remember when the movie Jaws came out and nobody would go in the water? I'm just picturing the same thing with kids. I'm not going in the canoe, Dad. I'm not going out
no.
there.
No. Honey, just don't sing. You'll be fine.
Yeah, right.
Actually,
just put a muzzle on the kid and take him out the canoe.
The singing thing reminded me, and this might just be because I'm drawing from my own childhood, but for some reason it reminded me so much of Pete's Dragon sort of the whistling that Pete always did, or that the dragon, I mean, it was that, I can't remember which one was whistling at this point, but I can remember painting lighthouses, and I can remember them just being together. And it sort of has that quality, as you're saying with Beauty and the Beast too, what can calm the monster of the deep, and it's just this sweet, pure song of a girl that just wants to be out paddling in the middle of the lake.
Yeah, you know, it's funny about when you mentioned the song that there's, you know, I was at first I thought, well, maybe I'll try to find a real song that exists, like a camp, like an old camp song from the 30s or 40s, and so I googled all these camp songs, and I think I googled songs about canoeing.
Oh, okay.
Or camp songs about canoeing or something like that. And these songs came up, they popped up, but they were like these old sort of romance songs, you know, like, we'll go out under the moon, we'll cuddle in the canoe. And I tried a couple of those and I thought, oh, this is really sending the wrong message. So I had to kind of, I couldn't find the right song. And finally I just said, well, Chris, you've been writing in rhyme for years. You know, you could probably write some lyrics that sound like a song. So I just sort of made those up on my own.
Oh, see, my favorite, this is like, boy, we were talking earlier about old episodes of the podcast. This brings me way back to when I talked to Lori Keller. And I brought up that in her Scrambled States book, there's a song that Kansas sings as he's like out in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, you know that every librarian sings that differently. We must. but I'm reading your book going like, oh, every one of us that's willing to sing in front of the children are going to have a melody. When I read this book, there was a melody that came to my mind, for sure.
It did?
Oh, well,
that's
yeah,
good.
For sure. Yeah, that's, I thought it was good. Wonderful. I mean, I, to the extent that as I'm reading it to children, I'm sure, because I'm also, you know, we as a librarian, we read it over and over, right, to multiple classes. That just solidifies the truth of that story to me, that this will be a part of the story, that there's a song in it. So I quite like that you did that. And even cooler to know that you're used to writing in rhyme and this was a break for you, and yet you couldn't resist writing in rhyme.
I know. I had to put some rhyme in there somewhere, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to lose my fan base, you know?
Oh, yeah. I thought it was great. No, I don't lose my fan base.
Right. Give them a little rhyme in there just to keep them happy. But I haven't, let it be known that I have not given up on rhyme. I'm writing other books, news stories in rhyme. So I'm not going totally cold turkey on the rhyme.
But you got to go with what fits. And in this case, the rhyme needed to be separate, I think, in order to call the sea monster out from the deep. It sort of served a purpose in that way, that if we had all rhyme, we might not have that break that we needed to call Hudson out from the deep.
Right. Well, you know, that's a funny story, because actually when I first wrote this story, this is probably, of all the books I've done so far, this is the one that I've had the most trouble with. I mean, I just didn't seem like I was ever happy with it. And it actually started out as a rhyming story. The whole thing was in rhyme.
Wait, is this when you reference in the back? I noticed there's a note in the back. I thought this was so sweet that you were like, thank you to my editor, Joan Powers, who carefully, for carefully tweaking 9 different versions of the story, I counted.
yeah, I did. I went through my file and I pulled out all these things like, oh my gosh, poor Joan. I mean,
you were really wrestling with this. That's great.
So it started out as a rhyming book, and it was actually a boy character. So it was a lot like a lot of my other books. It was a boy character and a rhyming story. And originally the title was, the boy's name was Henry. So it was Henry and Hudson. And I kind of like that sort of, you know, play on Henry Hudson, but yeah. Henry and Hudson. And so, I thought I had kind of a unique title there, and so I wrote this whole story in rhyme with this boy character. And then, you know, I would go around to school visits and I could tell a lot of the little girls that I presented to, they didn't actually come out and say it, but almost like it seemed like they were a little peeved that I hadn't had a girl character. One girl did ask me at a school visit, are you going to write for a girl character? And I said, and this was a real cop out. I said, well, Mercy Watson's a girl. And then she said, but Mercy Watson's a pig. And I was like, yeah, that doesn't really count, does it?
Also, to be fair, I believe Kate wrote Mercy Watson.
Yeah, that's true. Kate? Who's Kate? No.
This Kate woman? I just added her name on that.
So I felt like at some point I really needed to write, you know, from the girl's point of view. So I was working on this story with Henry as a character. I thought, oh, this might be perfect, you know, for a girl, because boys will relate to the monster, or they'll love the big monster, you know, and girls will relate with the main characters. So and I ran it past my agent, Steve Mock, and I said, what do you think? And he goes, oh, yeah. He said, that's a really good point. He said, that would really work. So I presented it to my editor, Joan. She said, yes. And so we changed. That's when we changed it to Hattie and Hudson. But it was still rhyming. It was still a rhyming story. And I was struggling with it. I just couldn't figure out why it wasn't working. I mean, I'd written it several times in rhyme, and Joan was kind of lukewarm about it, and I was kind of lukewarm about it, and Steve was kind of lukewarm about it.
This is where you mean that it wasn't working. Is that what you're saying, Chris? Like you had the whole manuscript out in rhyme, but it just didn't. There was just something like not. There wasn't something special about it that it didn't have.
Well,
that quality.
It just wasn't clicking. It just. Makes sense. And then I remember literally waking up one morning and thinking, oh, Chris, duh, this doesn't want to be a rhyming story. It's trying to tell you it does not want to be a rhyming story, because it's not. I mean, all the other books I've written in rhyme are, you know, there's a fair amount of humor in them. So they're, you know, they have sort of, you know, Mr. Miggy goes off and he gets caught in these wacky adventures, and the If I Built books are kind of over the top, you know, and so. And King Hugo and Randy Rowe, they all have a certain amount of humor. And even The Circus Ship has a certain amount of humor in it, too. And so I remember I got on the computer and I sent an email to my editor, Joan, and I said, I'm not I'm not sure this book wants to be a rhyming book. I said, what do you think? And she emailed me back. She said, why don't you take a couple pages and write them non-rhyming in prose and send them off to me? So I did. And I sent them right back. And she immediately got back to me. She said, this is so much better. She said, the rhyme was really holding you back. And yes. I said, yeah, I totally agree. So I rewrote the whole book in prose, and it was really hard. But because, you know, when you have the rhyme, you have the stanzas, and you have, you know, maybe for a spread, you maybe have three stanzas, maybe four stanzas, although that's pushing it a little bit. But you have this certain structure that you're working with, and it sort of makes it very clear how you're going to write the story, you know. But when you have all the words in the world to use, and you have, you know, some, it can be really long, it can be really short. It's like, oh my gosh, I kind of need that limit. So the first version I wrote in prose, it was really bare bones, because I remember people saying, you know, children's book, if you could show it in the illustration, don't put it in the text, blah, 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 you know, all that stuff that we all learn when we first start out. Yeah. And so I wrote this really bare bones story, and I sent it off to Joan. And she sent it back, and she goes, I think this needs some work. You know, and I remember I kind of moped around the house for a couple of days, and even my son said to my wife, he says, what's up with Dad? And she said, well, it's kind of like the teacher just gave him a D minus on a paper. And he goes, oh. And so, and I said, well, I got to do this. And basically what I did was I sort of cut out all the description and anything that sort of added sort of character to the story. I just kind of made it really cut and dry. And so she said, go back in and just, you know, add some details and some features that will really sort of liven up the text. And so I went back, and it took a couple more times, but eventually, you know, it came together. But like I said, yeah, in the back of the book, it says nine different versions. And I think it was like nine, maybe even more, but yeah, it took a while.
Did you, while you were doing those different text revisions, did you have like a working dummy? Did the story change through those revisions, or were you mostly changing the language that you were using?
Well, I didn't have. I never actually made a complete full dummy. I mean, a lot of times, especially if I'm working with a publisher that knows my stuff and I've worked with before, I'll send in some pretty tight sketches, but they'll just be like sketches on sheets of paper, so I don't actually put it up into dummy form, but I'll send off sketches. And I had some sketches. I mean, when I was working this, I did have some sketches. They were kind of rough. They weren't anything I was ready to show to the art director. But I did have some compositions in mind for the illustrations, and I knew it was going to be mostly full bleed spread illustrations, which I like, with an occasional single page. But yeah, I mean, I basically, when I was writing the story, I was tweaking the story without any illustrations, or certainly no finished illustrations, and some of the sketches were still pretty rough at that point. Yeah,
your illustrations, the way that I would describe it to other people that haven't seen this yet, is that we are out on this lake, excuse me, and it feels like you've got this camera that just keeps, like a news camera that just keeps circling Hudson, that just keeps circling the sea monster. You're just showing us every vantage point of that lake. And my word, though, the greatest illustration, I think, in the whole thing for me, the thing that made me feel like I've never seen something like this in a children's book before, is when you put that camera all the way down on the bottom of the lake, and we are looking up, really the first shot that we have of Hudson, where there's just these like craggy rocks underneath the water, and the water fades to green. My goodness, that illustration is insane. I obsess over that picture. I love it so much.
Oh, thank you so much. That's one of my favorites actually in the book too. I first did an underwater scene. Well, I always loved underwater scenes, and you know, I was just a huge Dr. Seuss fan, still am, but even when I was like a little kid, you know, my mom would take us to the library, and I would just like stack all this Dr. Seuss books and just like lug them up to the desk and take them out. But he would occasionally do that. He would put like an underwater scene where there was this like crazy, you know, one of his crazy creatures in like a little cave, and the narrator would be diving down. I remember, I think it was like On Beyond Zebra. There was one like that. There was, yeah. And I just loved that. I loved that sort of underwater scene. So, and I did one in my third book, which was called If I Built a Car. I did an underwater scene that I really liked too. So, yeah, that definitely had to make an appearance in this book.
Well, and I feel like the other thing you're doing here too, the treatment that you're offering up for the reader, is that you're showing the sea monster from as many different vantage points as possible. And that gives us a sense of how long he is and just how big he is and how powerful. And I especially love that there's some of these images that are almost like reminiscent of a dinosaur, because there's this massive neck coming up that goes so right. high that it folds beyond the page. And then the head comes back down onto the page. And that feeling, Chris, my gosh, the feeling that this monster has a real size, a size that you've squeezed onto the page, but then look how much smaller everything else has to become. That was something that I was really entranced by.
Oh, thank you so much. That's great. Yeah, I did, you know, I've listened to a bunch of your podcasts over the years, and I've heard other illustrators say this, and I've actually heard you say this too, but a lot of times I'll approach an illustration almost like a movie director.
Yes.
And so I'm setting up the shot, and what's the best way to show this? Am I going to be right down the, like a worm's eye view, right down the ground level looking up, or the water level looking up, or am I going to be underwater, or am I going to see this character from the back, or, you know, or a lot of times I'll throw an aerial view in there. And it's just a way to sort of break the book up, especially for a kid who's sitting on a mom or dad's lap. You know, they want to see things. They want to see a different, you know, they want to be excited by these things. And so I just try to compose each illustration in the most exciting way, in the most exciting perspective, and, you know, just to sort of, you know, just make it as visually interesting as possible.
But you also pull off this great emotional effect in so after after the whole lake first has this encounter with the sea monster, Hattie decides, I'm gonna sneak back out at night and see him one more time, and that scene shows us not only how brave and just sort of like, I'm gonna go do this and I feel confident that it's completely safe Hattie is, but the scene specifically I'm talking about, which is like your Jaws picture, is that at night we have this top-down, but you know what I'm talking about, where the moon is reflecting off of Hudson's eyes, and so there's these, like, glowing eyes coming up out of the water, and on the next page we see him, and she's just like, hi, I'm Hattie.
Yeah, I would never do anything she did. I would be a total weenie. Even if I'm swimming in a deep lake, and I can't look down in water with my eyes open, because it just freaks me out. when you see the beams of light just going down into the darkness. I don't think I could do anything that Hattie does in this book, but I'm glad she does.
Yeah. It's neat that you can explore it through her. I think, I didn't connect that you were from Maine prior to reading this. And so one of my questions was just going to be, where do you see this happening? But I asked that because my setting was Lake Winnipesaukee. As I'm looking at this going like, I've been up there. It feels like this massive lake that something could be in there. I don't know what could be down there.
Yeah. Well, we do have some very deep lakes in Maine. I grew up in southwestern Maine, and that was right near the second biggest lake in Maine, Sebago Lake. And Sebago Lake is, oh gosh, I think, it's, well, you know, someone's going to write in or call in or something, but I think it's like 300 feet or something, or maybe even more than that in places. And it's so deep that they used to do, train World War II bombers over the lake. And my dad grew up over there too. When he was a kid, he used to watch the fighter planes coming across the lake and bombing these targets in the lake. But during that time, a British plane crashed the lake and sunk. And the plane's still down there, and with the remains of the British pilot, test pilot, that is still in the bottom of the lake. And some, I'm getting off the point here, aren't I? But some guy was going to resurrect. He wanted to bring the plane up because it's so perfectly preserved. It's been in the bottom of this lake, you know, this really cold lake, and the British government got involved and said, "No, you can't. That's like a sacred burial site, and you can't touch that." So it's still thrown down the bottom of the lake. But yeah, we have all these deep lakes, and I kind of pictured this. I modeled the lake that Hattie lives on in a lake in the town where I live, and it's called McGuntucook Lake. It's a big lake, and it's fairly deep. I think that's only like 60 or 70 feet at its deepest point. But still, I mean, I'm swimming out there in that lake, and I look down, and I get to the bottom, I freak out. But I did sort of go out, and I took pictures of the lake. I used a friend's camp as a model for the camp where Hattie and Hudson, not Hudson, no, Hattie and her parents live. And I took some pictures of some of the islands and the way the light reflects off the water and things like that. And the thing about the lake in McGuntucook Lake where I live, it's sort of unusual because it's surrounded by fairly large mountains. So you get these sort of beautiful backgrounds and things. So it's definitely sort of based on that lake. I mean, it's not perfect. I didn't like duplicate it exactly, but that was definitely the inspiration for the book.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you know, going back to the British airplane that I can't stop thinking about. All I can think of is, well, there's your issue right there. You also can't go down there. The British have guarded it with a sea monster. They're not going to let anybody take it back. This burial site is now guarded by a sea monster. Sorry,
yeah,
guys.
I should have painted that in the background. That would have been so cool. Yeah.
I don't know why
I got off on that tangent, but I just think that's one of these fascinating main stories.
Because it's amazing. There's like lake lore. That's how you got off on it.
Yeah, exactly.
I like the setting, though. I like the way that the setting plays as a character in this, and that the way, as I was saying before, that it felt like you kept turning the camera to show us all these little islands that were dotting the surface of the lake, and just the work that you did to separate the green of Hudson from really everything else. There was a lot of work that I can see that allows him to just be a big old green lovable giant, but also
he's definitely a little different. Yeah, different green than the trees, you mean?
Yeah, but I was going to say, but also then the different green from the trees, but also green matching the water down where he is. So it allows him to sort of blend back into where he was hiding.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people paint water as underwater as blue. But if you actually go underwater in a lake, especially in Maine, and if you have like a swim mask on or something, a lot of time it's kind of this olivey green color.
It's full of life. That's why it's green.
Yeah. So I was, you know, I remembered that from, because I love to snorkel and I love to snorkel in the lakes in Maine. So I remember that from snorkeling. But I also, you know, before I did that picture that you mentioned earlier of the underwater scene, I did do some, you know, I did look through some Google images of underwater and lakes in Maine, and there were some great photos came up, and they all sort of had that sort of olivey green. Sometimes they sort of blend from a light blue up toward the water where the light is down to sort of like an olivey green. So that's what I tried to capture in that picture.
A gradient, yeah. When you're doing your compositions, some of these you're also drawing things really tiny. I almost imagine you painting at like, you know, twice the scale of what made it into the book.
I'd love to, but I can't.
I know, right? Yeah. These are all wall paintings that we shrunk to picture book size.
Right. We peeled the frescoes off the chapel and then sent them to the publisher. No, actually, what it was, I do work a little bit larger. I do, I generally tend to work about 115% up. And that allows me to paint the detail in, you know, and I work all in gouache. So it's all painting. In fact, when I go to schools, like kids say, you must use a computer to like to do the sky and stuff. And no, that's all paint because, you know, gouache can, if you have large areas, sometimes it can dry completely flat with no brush strokes or any variation. You know, it looks like almost like you clicked a button and you dropped in this blue or something. But, But it's all painted. But if I work 115%, I can add those details, and then, you know, when it shrinks down, it just sort of tightens up the whole illustration. Yeah. And it actually really works well.
It does, yeah. For the especially the sort of like ancillary characters inside the lake, the fish swimming around, the bats, the things like that. You're right. It does make it a little bit tighter.
Right.
How long does it take you then from these compositions to where you are now, to do a typical painting, especially for this book, because you had so much playing with light, the light going through the water, the light, the moonlight and sunlight, both reflecting off of the droplets of water that were coming off of Hudson as he came out. There was so much work here you did with I think making that water feel real, making it feel like it was a, you know, like it was a real scene.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, sometimes that's it sort of happens accidentally. There's a scene, there's a picture in the back of the book. Look at scene. I sound like I'm talking about movies.
There's totally a scene,
in the closing shot. But there's a picture in the back of the book where Hattie is sort of appealing to the townspeople and sort of convincing them for the monster to stay, for Hudson to stay. And it's she's standing on the town pier, which is like a large dock over the lake, and there's like a little gas station, little convenience store off to the side, and a gas pump there, but down the lower left-hand corner, you can see just the bow of a boat coming in, and it's kind of shallow there, and down to the ripples, I painted this sort of this rocky bottom, and it just wasn't sure it was going to work, and I just painted it, and I just said, oh my gosh, that looks so good. So I just left it. And so sometimes things, you know, these little accidents happen with the gouache and you go, oh yeah, I really nailed that. But you know, it doesn't happen all the time, but it's nice when it does.
That, to know that there are things in your art that are accidental is awesome to know.
Oh, well, I've talked to other illustrators too. And a lot of them say the same thing. You know, when you start a new book, first of all, I drag my heels. I just, you know, to get into the rhythm of a book, it takes me a long time. So
really,
you know, the first
now?
Illustration might take like 3 or 4 weeks. And by the end of the book, I'm doing these double page spreads in like, you know, 3 days or something, you know. But the first ones are kind of slow moving. And I feel like sometimes when I start a book, I was like, oh my gosh, I've totally forgotten how to illustrate.
I
look at the illustration board and I think, I don't know how to do this anymore.
Chris,
and I've talked to other illustrators, they say, I have that too. It's like, I guess it's like the artist's equivalent to a writer's block. you just look and you go, no, what do I do first? But then after a while, I mean, it just sort of comes back to, but it's just, it's a weird thing. I mean, and Hudson's like my 10th book that I've written, and I've illustrated a whole bunch of other books, and I still think, well, do I know how to do this? It's just, I don't know. It's a self-deprecating thing, I guess. I don't know.
I think it feels good to hear that this many years and this many books into it, that you still have those feelings. I think that sort of normalizes it for people that are not at that place in their career. That helps.
Yeah, I wish it was just automatic, but it's still a struggle, and I'll get like a quarter of the way through the illustration, and I'll think to myself, am I going to pull this one off? I don't know. I don't like the way this is going, but you know, I'm just going to keep hanging in there and see what happens. And luckily, a lot of times, you know, it all comes together in the end. But boy, there's some dicey moments there.
it's
very strange.
If things were automatic, though, then you'd be taking out fear out of the equation, and I think that fear is something necessary for people to do well, for all of us to do well in like all tasks. I feel like that fear, that risk, is something that allows us to amplify our senses and create our best work.
You know, I think you're absolutely right there, and I actually like to see. When I look at, you know, paintings or go to a museum and I'm going to an exhibit, I like to see the struggle. I like to see where the artist, he kind of, you know, he didn't quite get this part, but, you know, this part's really good. And it's people like, when I see like paintings by like John Singer Sargent, I swear he must have sold his soul to the devil or something, because it's like, it's so perfect. It's just like, there's like no struggle. It's just like he, you know, he was possessed and he just painted it and it just came out perfect. It's like, you never see this. And then you see other painters and you go, oh, they really messed up that face, but I still like the painting, you know? And so I like to see that struggle. And you know, hopefully you don't see a lot of it in my work. That's horrible to say, but yeah, I mean, yeah, there's still, you know, it's every book is its own thing and you never know how it's going to turn out. It's a very strange business. Let's put it that way, Matthew.
Well, yeah, I mean, not only with you not knowing how it's going to turn out, but then you have that other weird component of it, which is that books also, you know, there's ownership in the reader and in what they make of the book and how they interact with the book. It's sort of a weird thing, but I mean, it's cool. And you've been doing it for a while, so you've gotten to see your books take on all sorts of different lives from what they were when you were working on them. So I can't wait to see how that happens with Hattie and Hudson. I can't wait to, I mean, gosh, really, let's be honest. The thing I'm most excited about is hearing all about your school visits where people like recreate giant sea monsters in their schools. That's going to be amazing. Because yeah. I still am an 8-year-old boy and that's what I'm living for right now.
Well, weren't we all fascinated by monsters when we were kids? You know, I think it's a universal thing. It's like dinosaurs, you know? They say you can never go wrong by writing a dinosaur book because kids are always going to be fascinated by dinosaurs. And for me, I just, you know, it was the Loch Ness Monster when they were kept finding these pictures of the Loch Ness Monster. And it was like, wow, that was so cool.
Yeah.
Just love that.
It's awesome to be able to see you tap into that wonder when you're making this book too. So that's, it's great. Congratulations, Chris. This is great. Another awesome book. And
thank you so much.
And one that I just am marveling at. Listen, before I wrap up with you, I want to bring us back to those students, back to your readers, because you've shown them now some of the early drafts, and for them to be able to hold finished copies will be exciting. So let me give you a chance to address them by saying that I'll see a library full of children tomorrow morning. Is there a message that I can bring to them from you, Chris?
All right, so I've been thinking about this. I kind of wish you still had that kickball question. Because I had like the perfect member for that team. Yeah. I guess my message to kids would be, when you get home from school today, don't plunk down on the couch and turn on the TV or grab the iPad or cell phone. Instead, go outside. Take a deep breath of fresh air, close your eyes, turn your face to the sun, feel the warmth on your face, and then just sort of, if you live near some woods, go out and explore. You know, like pull up a rock and see what's living under the rock or an old stump. We had this woods behind my house when we were growing up, and we'd pull up stumps and we'd find these little salamanders and stuff, and it was so cool. Or if you're lucky enough to live like next to a little stream, you know, clear out the tree dams and send little stick canoes down and see how far they can go. I guess I would just sort of encourage kids to go outside and play and just explore. I think that's really important.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 350 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. And Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with the books they'll love. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect any ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Başak Aoğlu shares the almost impossible thing, her debut picture book about shared dreams and a seemingly unreachable possibility. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.